Sarah Driver. And next to Sarah on the other end, Frances Poole from the University of Delaware, who is one of the rescuers of the film. Frances.
Sarah, let me start if I could. Talk a little bit about the moment when this was made. I mean, one of the things that, while watching it, that brought me back was that this was really a moment before the phrase American independent cinema was spoken about and whatever. Talk a little bit about the scene and seeing names like Luke Sant and Nan Golden and Phil Klein and a lot of people up there really brought back an era.
It was a fantastic period of filmmaking in New York because there were no rules, there were no unions, there were no... For people making low-budget films like ourselves. And the streets were pretty much ours, so we could just go out and shoot what we wanted. We worked on each other's films. I produced Jim's Permanent Vacation and Stranger Than Paradise, and he shot my movies. He shot this movie, and he shot Sleepwalk, my first feature. We really had a kind of attitude, which was, anybody can pick up a camera, anybody can pick up a guitar, you know, just try to make it work. And if you make mistakes, then we learn from them. And and this film was actually sort of unusual in the whole scene of downtown New York because it was an adaptation of a story by Paul Bowles, who was an author whose books I couldn't really find in the late 70s. I had to go to an English bookstore in order to get his books before they were republished. And I was a huge fan of his writing. And I remember I read this story, and it was a 7-page story, and I was shocked by it. I was like totally stunned. And I was like, wow, what happened at the end? And I thought, I got to direct this movie exactly how I first read the story. So I tried to stay really true to the story. And then Phil Klein had been Jim's, who's a wonderful composer, had been Jim's best friend since fourth grade, and he lived around the corner from us. Nan lived down the street. We all lived very near each other. And Nan and Suzanne Fletcher, the lead actress in the film, they had run away from home together when they were 16. And all these people who were coloring outside the lines are all sort of ended up in lower Manhattan. And there were a lot of different people, art forms of people who were all congregating and meeting, and we were all germinating each other at that time. It was a very exciting time to be young and an artist in New York.
I first saw the film, as you know, at the Rotterdam Festival, and then had the pleasure of bringing the film to Chicago, and I was working at that time. And then, as we know, the film kind of disappeared. Can you talk a little bit about how that happened?
Well, we had put the film in a storage facility. I had an inner negative, an inner positive. The film was distributed, which was surprising for a 48-minute film. It was shown, actually, with Pull My Daisy. It was in distribution with the Robert Frank film in France. And it was available in Japan and other places. And we had everything in one storage facility. And there was a terrible flood, and that we lost everything. I lost everything, inner negative, negative, everything. And I only had one festival print left. It was a torn print that Jim and I quickly made a 1-inch copy from that print. And then like 3 years ago, we looked at the 1-inch copy and the signal had disappeared on that. There was nothing. And that's what happens with digital. After a period of time, you can lose its signal. So I thought I had nothing. And I couldn't even talk about it. And then Frances called. And Frances said, I found a print of your film in Tangier among Paul Bowles' things.
Frances, you want to pick it up from there?
Yeah, that's Frances' story.
you want me to say something about finding it, the
yeah.
film? Well, I was in Tangier in 2008 in May to attend a conference and staying at the hotel.
A little more into the microphone.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Staying at the hotel and trying to enjoy being back in Tangier. I'd lived there in the late 70s and early 80s and met Paul Bowles and knew him. And I got a call from his heir, Abdelwahed Boulej, who said, I have some things that belong to Paul. I wonder if you would care to see them, be interested in maybe having them for the University of Delaware Library Paul Bowles collection. I said, oh yeah, great. I'd be really excited to see him. So he came around, picked me up, and we drove to part of Tangier I hadn't been to before, and he led me into this little abandoned apartment building, into a room that was lit by one light bulb, and the place was just completely covered. The floor was completely covered with letters, papers. There were books, Paul Bowles, the materials from his apartment, and I started taking digital photographs. I had a little digital camera and started shooting pictures. And as I moved around the room, I looked over in one corner. There was a bookcase, and I saw a film case. So I looked at it. I couldn't tell in the light. I couldn't read the address, except it said New York. So I took a photo, and I had to leave after the conference, went back to Delaware, the university, and I showed the head of special collections the pictures. I said, I'm really curious about this film. I don't know what it is, but why would Paul Bowles keep this film? And where has it been all these years? So we went back in February and worked for a week gathering up everything, got the film. I put it in my carry-on bag, took a train to Casablanca, then to Madrid and back to the States. And it wasn't until I got back to the University of Delaware and put it on a film viewer that I saw the title. And at that point, I was still puzzled. What is this? I know the story, but who is Sarah Driver? What is going on here with this film? So I started doing research, and it took me a while, and I finally was able to contact her and say, I have a film. I didn't know it was the only print. So it was a big shock to me when Sarah said, it's the only surviving print of the film, and that it was in relatively good condition after some 30 years in Tangier. So that's, maybe that's too long a story to tell, but we brought it back, and we've been working together since then. And Susan Lazarus has been involved, other people in my department, film restoration company has been working on it. And amazingly, the film held up. Physically, it could have been destroyed in the heat and humidity of Tangier. Plus, it was covered with insecticide when I found it.
Do you think that's what preserved the film?
Maybe, yeah. That was called the poison pants week I spent there. But maybe that's too much to tell. But
how did Paul Bowles get the film?
I read the story, and then I went ahead, as we all had that very attitude that we were unstoppable. I went ahead and made the film without the rights. And then I wrote to Paul Bowles because William Burroughs used to live around the corner from us, and I got his address through William Burroughs. My friend Howard Bruckner was making a documentary about Burroughs at the time. And so I wrote to Paul, and I said, I made this film. Who should I go to? How can I get the rights to it? And he said, oh, you have to see my agent, Ned Levitt, at William Morris. And I went, oh, no. And I didn't have any money. I didn't know what to do. So I went up to see Ned. I showed him the film. He said, it's a good thing you made the film first, because I wouldn't have given you the rights if you hadn't, and I love the film. So we'll give you all the rights. And then Paul and I started to have this exchange, this letter exchange, which was so fantastic. And then when this whole thing happened with finding the print, it made me revisit those letters from Paul. And he was so generous to a 24-year-old filmmaker who out of the blue contacted him, and so eloquent and so supportive. And so I sent him the print, because you didn't have VHS then. You had nothing, no other way he could see the film. And I was very curious to know what he would think, and I wanted to thank him for the rights. So I sent the film to him, and until Francis's phone call, I had forgotten that I had this this young man named Guy Zimmerman, who was also in our circle, who's a playwright. He told me that his parents were friends with Paul and Jane, and he was going to Tangier. This was in 82. And I said, can you please carry this print to Paul Bowles? So he carried the print to Paul Bowles and projected it for Paul. And he said he's going to write up his story at some point, because I'm so curious, since he was in the room with Paul while Paul was watching it, what know, because Paul wrote me his critique of the film, but I wonder what really happened, right, you know, being in the room with him after he saw the film, what he felt. And it was interesting because Francis and I have been, we're traveling, and there's some other people, Regina, who we were traveling this past year because it was the 100th birthday of Paul Bowles, and the film was shown to a lot of Bowles scholars, and I thought, oh my gosh, this could be the hardest crowd. And they were very embracing of the film. The people who knew Paul, had worked with Paul, had studied Paul's writings, and one of the interesting things that came out was they said this story reminds them more of a Jane story than a Paul story, because it's an unusual story for Paul. And I hadn't realized that until meeting all these wonderful people who are connected with Paul Bowles, Paul and Jane.
Okay, let's get some questions from all of you. Yes, ma'am. Let me just repeat the questions. The first is if Sarah could just go over the dates, when the film was made, when it was sent to Bowles, when it was rediscovered, etc. And the second, this viewer finds a kind of link between the film and Eraserhead. I was wondering what you thought of that connection.
Well, other people had said that when the film was first made about Eraserhead, and I hadn't seen Eraserhead at that point. Maybe it was a synchronicity in the atmosphere of, but I'm a huge David Lynch fan. And the film, we shot it in 1980. It was finished in 81. Did the festival circuit and everything. And then we discovered it was missing in about 1998. And then Francis contacted me I sent the print to Paul in 1982. Francis contacted me in the summer of 2009.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So when you see it again, or maybe there's upon your series of viewings and seeing it this many years, what do you see in it that you know you can enlighten us in terms of how you evolved as a filmmaker, or how you see how you captured it then, and do you see things about yourself in it now that you wouldn't have noticed then?
How does Sarah Driver react to seeing the film now after so many years, and what is her, I guess, take on the film now after so many years?
Well, I think, now I can be objective. I think it was kind of good to have a 30-year period where I couldn't see it. You know, I feel like a different person. But I feel like it was truly, I wanted to do something to honor Paul, and I feel like I did that. I was trying to be very true to his words and his work and how his story affected me, and I think I was very true with that. I think Suzanne is remarkable. Seeing her again, just her performance is really, really great. And you know, it was made with such a wonderful spirit. It was only six days. I made every single meal. I had everything, you know, I fed everybody. We all had like 9 jobs. And a very tiny crew. And it was a wonderful way to work. And it, in a way, it's a shame that things have gotten so, everything is so difficult now, it seems like, to make a move to, you know, you got to check and get rights and do this and do that. You don't have the freedom of expression in the same way that we could express things then, because everything's so tied up with everybody being afraid of getting sued and stuff. So I don't know, I think the film's as creepy as I intended it to be, so I'm very happy. As creepy as the story was when I read it.
The affinity I was curious about was Carnival of Souls, but the other stuff that one had was how did you enlist the cooperation of the Washington Fire Department? It's a rural town in the Chilicoot.
Yes. Could you talk about how you got the fire department involved in the film?
Well,
Well, I had $150 for that whole accident scene. So and they had a training school, a fire training school, the Washington Fire Department. So I said, if I brought three cars there, and would you blow them up for me, and I'll bring you a keg of beer. So I bought three cars for $50, and the towing, that included the cost of towing. And then they blew them up for me, and they were very happy. And you know, because they got to exercise their talents. And then their brothers and cousins all called me from the ambulance department that night and said they wanted to be in the movie. So then I wrote the ambulance scene for the movie. And then the fire department got really mad at me because they didn't want the ambulance, their brothers and cousins, to be in the movie. So it's a rural town. They were lovely, absolutely lovely.
Yes, sir.
Hi, someone referenced the Eraserhead and Carnival of Souls. I was thinking sort of more what came a half decade after, specifically Richard Kern and that sort of Sonic Youth, where they use his visuals for submitting to make short films. You have these dreamy monologues or this only music. Was Kern or Sonic Youth hanging around your screenings at that time? Do you know if you had a direct influence on it?
Oh, I don't.
This viewer says that aside from Carnival of Souls and also Eraserhead, he detected an influence this film had on the work of Richard Kern, especially the work he did with Sonic Youth, and was wondering if there was any connection, personal or otherwise, of
Well, that. Kim Gordon and I used to work in a Xerox shop together.
Her monologues are just like, you know, if you think of Submit to Me and The Opening of Bad Moon Rising, it's the same kind of dreamy monologue goes on with your music. That opens their second album, their first single. It's almost identical.
Oh, wow. I don't know if I did or not. But Kim and I did work in a Xerox during the hiatus between the first half hour of Stranger the Paradise, which was shot in 82, and the second half, which was shot in 84. It took us a year and a half to get the rest of the money for Stranger the Paradise. I worked in a Xerox shop with Kim Gordon from Sonic Youth.
And so there's a connection.
So there's, we shared a job. But I'm sure the aesthetic, well, we all affected each other, always, you know.
Yes. Is the Bowles story also a first-person narrative with a voiceover that you adapted for the film? And could you share what Paul Bowles' reaction was?
Yes, it's pretty. The text is pretty much totally lifted from the story. I mean, it was a 12-page script. It was a 7-page story. Paul wrote me that he liked the film very much. He was a very austere person. It wasn't. You know, but he said he liked the film very much. He said the oldest actress, Evelyn Smith, had overacted a bit. But he was very pleased with Suzanne's performance. And I think he was very pleased with the film. And, you know, I think he wasn't always happy with all the adaptations that were done on his work. So.
I was going to ask you, what was his experience with the cinema, generally?
You would know better, Francis.
This was the first film made based on a Paul Bowles story. So the only other one the German filmmaker Friedrich Schleich made Half Moon, which I think consists of three short adaptations. I don't know if I should say this, but he wasn't really fond of the Bertolucci. I hope he's not in the audience. I saw Paul after he had gone to Paris to see the film premiered, and he was very disappointed in it for reasons I won't get into here. You could probably, you know, search it, but that's really all. You know, I know Frieder and his.
Was he much of a film fan, Paul Bowles?
Did he go to the Cinematheque in Tangier?
Paul never had a television until probably the last 5 years of his life. He never watched movies as such in Tangier that often because they were mainly films made by Eastern European countries. I'm talking about like travel films, like the Ministry of Travel in Bulgaria would send films to Tangier and they would be screened in the Reef Cinema and some of the other theaters in town. So I don't think he went out much to see film in Tangier. There just wasn't that much opportunity. But I think he loved film, when he had a chance, sure.
Yes, in the back there, ma'am.
Sir? Sarah, this was a particular time in 1979, 1980. Downtown, where there's a lot of cross-pollination between visual artists, musicians, and filmmakers. And the female filmmakers at the time, like Debbie, Vivian, and Dick, made films that were different than the sort of films that the guys were making, which were mainly genre films. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that particular time and how people worked together and competed together. Also, could you talk about Phil Klein?
The two questions. First, as Sewer says in his memory, that at that time the women filmmakers like Vivian Dick or Beth B made films that were distinctive from those of the men, male filmmakers, who he said were probably more interested in genre and things like that. And I guess to talk about that and then also to talk about Phil Klein.
Well, I think, I mean, it's true. I mean, I think it's a hard question because I don't know, I think women often deal more with mythology and archetypes and dreams in their work, maybe, than maybe that's the difference between a male and a female. I don't know. I know, you know, a lot of the, like Vivian's films have a lot to do with symbolism and metaphor. It's more poetic and more dreamlike, I think, than some of the male filmmakers were making. And Betty Gordon, too, of course, Empty Suitcases. I know, it's a very difficult question for me to answer. I think also the women filmmakers were also kind of, as women are in this industry, were somewhat underrated and their films were underviewed and underprojected, and the men's films were, of course, given a little more attention. But I think I think there are a lot of incredible women filmmakers working today that are having a rough time trying to get stuff done, including myself. But Phil Klein, it's easier for me to talk about Phil. Phil Klein is an amazing composer. The part where she's driving and there's that strange dreamlike music that was elevator music that he collaged together. And I went over to his apartment before I made the film and I went, I have to use that piece somewhere. That's incredible. And Phil, I don't know if you guys know about this thing called Unsilent Night that Phil does at Christmas time, where he gives like 2,000 tapes and tape players and people walk through the streets of Manhattan with holding these boom boxes and playing these tapes, and they echo. He gets the most, he finds streets that will really, the sound will really bounce around and stuff, and then he has this whole procession, and it's grown. It was like 100 people when it started, and now it's like 2,000 or 3,000 people who come for this Unsilent Nights. All over the world he does them now. And actually he and Jim are preparing a opera about Tesla, Nikola Tesla, right now. And then he also did the music for my film Sleepwalk. And he would give me pieces of music and then I placed them accordingly. He would give me a sort of feeling and an ambience, and then I would place the music where I thought it was appropriate. And I have also, I do a lot with music and using effects, sound effects, and I sort of weave sound effects into the music to make them almost part of the music as well, which I've done with all my films.
Questions? Let's see if we've got anyone who hasn't asked yet. Okay, all the way in the back there. Yes, Yelena.
How was your collaboration with Jim Jarmusch?
About Sarah's collaboration with Jim Jarmusch? Is that the question? Yeah.
Well, have always shared, had fun playing with ideas together. He shot my films. I produced his films early on. We still, writer I was working with, Bill Radin, he and I gave Jim the idea for Broken Flowers. I always call it kind of like a creative tennis almost, like where we're always throwing around ideas and batting them back and forth and celebrating ideas and the imagination. I mean, we're both very, we kind of think the imagination rules everything. So that's where we really, where we, the meetings of our minds. But out of necessity, we worked on each other's films early on.
Yes, sir. You have one more?
I've had 5 scripts I've been trying to get off the ground. I have a new
question. Questions about what Sarah's working on.
Yeah, I have a, I had a really wonderful adaptation of Two Serious Ladies, the Jane Bowles, which I spent 7 years trying to get money to make, and people kept saying, but who's the, what's the leading man? And I'm like, but it's called Two Serious Ladies. There is no leading man. And I spent years kind of like a donkey chasing a carrot that kept getting really close, and then I couldn't bite the carrot and get that one going. Then I wrote a script called Deaf, Dumb, and Blonde that was a silent movie where the lead person, the lead actress, loses her hearing at the very beginning, and then she's driven by the sounds in her head, and it's almost like a conspiracy film that was a, you know, kind of, I wanted to make almost like a German expressionist movie, which I couldn't get financing for. Then I wrote a script called Gone with the Mind, like Gone with the Wind, but Gone with the Mind. That was a very, very funny script, and it works on many, many levels, and we're still hoping for financing on that. And then I wrote one that was an homage to Hammer films called They Live Among Us. And now I have a project, because I've always loved fairy tales, and I noticed that there's nothing for children or even childlike people in the world having, in terms of film, of that kind of thing. So I've written a, it's called Tales from the Hanging Head, and it's 7 metamorphosis tales, and I'm giving them to 6 other directors. And see, I adapted them, the stories, and brought them into the present. And I now have 5 directors secured who are going to do them. And they'll each be like 10 to 12 minutes long, and then they'll be put together as a feature. And I have these wonderful French producers working with me, and I feel very lucky. So I'm hoping that will, thank you. I'm hoping that will get kicking.
Well, we look forward to those, but right now, thank you very much for bringing the film back here. And Francis, thank you for bringing the film back to all of us. Thanks for coming.
There are copies I put together of the finding of the film in Tangier, and they're out on the table. If you're welcome to take one.